Today at Reader's Corner, Michael Waldman, author of The Fight to Vote. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In honor of Veterans Day, and with the midterm elections in our rearview mirror, we're discussing the history of voting rights on today's show with my guest, Michael Waldman. He is the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's School of Law and the author of The Fight to Vote. In the book, Mr. Waldman describes voting rights as an American struggle as old as the country itself. Today, we are continuing to work through the many thorny issues that were first faced by the Founding Fathers. These include fear of voter fraud, struggling to define who can vote, and deciding exactly where and when those citizens can cast their ballot. Mr. Waldman reminds us that the fight to vote is at the heart of American history, and it is up to all of us to advance that fight and keep it at the center of debate. Mr. Waldman is the author of several previous books, including The Second Amendment. He is a constitutional lawyer, writer, and expert on the presidency and American democracy. The Brennan Center is a nonpartisan law and policy institute that works to improve the systems of democracy and justice. Mr. Waldman has led the center since 2005. He joins us today by phone from his offices at NYU School of Law. Michael Waldman, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, let's start with this work in progress, voting in America. You point out that this goes all the way back to the beginning. And as a matter of fact, apparently voting in the early days of the Republic was, as you called it, a contact sport. Help us understand what it was like to try to vote in those days.
Well, you're exactly right. You know, we have fights right now over voting, over who can vote, over intimidation of voters. Many of us might wonder, well, gee, why is this happening now? This seems like this was something that was kind of a settled issue. And it turns out that these fights over voting, over how we run our democracy, are intense and they're contentious and obviously consequential. But they are not new. They go back all the way to the very beginning of the country. At the time of the country's founding, and for many years afterwards, voting could be a rather raucous activity. It was conducted outdoors very frequently. There was not a secret ballot. Very often people would line up in one place or another. If you supported one candidate, you would stand over here. If you supported the other candidate, you would stand over there. And you can imagine there'd be a lot of incentive for people to kind of use their fists or more to keep the other side from getting their votes. One of my favorite stories is that when Abraham Lincoln was casting his vote when he was running for president in 1860, he had what we would now call a photo op. He was casting his ballot, and the reporters from around the country in Springfield, Illinois, were interviewing him as he what he thought was going to happen in the election and so forth. And while he was doing this, behind him, an editor of a local paper was caning somebody from the other party, hitting them over the head with his cane over a dispute over forged ballots. And apparently that kind of violence was considered sort of not a big deal. That was like barely mentioned that it was going on behind him as he was giving his press conference. So it was a bit rowdy.
Well, speaking of Lincoln, it reminds me of another story you tell in your book regarding the expansion of voting rights when in 65 he was giving a speech which ended up having very deadly consequences.
Well, you're exactly right. This fight over voting was always seen as central to the American story because we Americans from the beginning understood that voting was at the heart of what it meant to be an American. It was at the heart of citizenship. It was at the heart of power. So Lincoln, before he was president and even as president, was never for extending the right to vote to African Americans. He was actually against it. But the Civil War radicalized Lincoln and changed him on this as on so many other things. And by the end of the Civil War, 1 out of 10 Union soldiers was African American. And in fact, when Lincoln gave his glorious second inaugural, about half the crowd to whom he spoke were black men and women, many in uniform. A few days after the surrender at Appomattox, Lincoln got up to speak from a second floor window of the White House. And he had never given very many big speeches, and this was his first chance to really say what he wanted to do with Reconstruction, with what would happen after the war was over. And in the middle of this long speech, he said, by the way, I've been criticized because my plans do not extend the right to vote to the former slaves. I now agree with that. And he said he thought that the right to vote should be extended. He gave some conditions and some categories. In fact, to a cabinet meeting a few days later, he indicated that he was perhaps ready to go all the way. At least one listener in that crowd hearing this in the middle of this long speech understood the significance of it. John Wilkes Booth was there. And when Lincoln said this, Booth gasped, that means citizenship. That is the last speech he will ever give. And he tried to get the guy standing next to him to shoot Lincoln on the spot. And when he wouldn't do it, then Booth vowed, well, then, by God, I will put him through myself. And of course, just a few days later, went to Ford's Theater.
Yeah.
It was that turn by Lincoln toward voting rights that at least sparked Booth's hatred at that moment. He wasn't a big Lincoln fan before that. I don't want to give the wrong idea. But that was
right.
What did it.
Well, let's jump forward. Speaking of African Americans' right to vote, in 1965, President Lyndon Johnson proposed and the Congress passed the Voting Rights Act of that year. It was an incredible piece of legislation that to this day is a really landmark law. Would you start by describing just what that law did, and especially the I think it's called the preclearance provision? And then, of course, where I'm going with this is that I'd like you to take us up to current times and what happens later. But let's start with a little bit of recent history anyway.
Absolutely. So as you know and your listeners know, after the Civil War, for a time, voting rights really were extended to black men by the 15th Amendment to the Constitution. But then it was really taken away, and you had the Jim Crow laws, as they were called, these southern states with constitutions and laws that effectively completely disenfranchised their black citizens from about the 1890s into the 1960s. And that was a dominant fact, certainly in their lives, but in the life of the country and our politics. And the civil rights movement was pushing and pushing, and there were occasional court victories. But for all the great victories on segregation, on the Montgomery bus boycott, even the Civil Rights Act, voting rights remained the hardest thing. In 1965, in a short period of time, that changed. You had the march in Selma, Alabama, where Dr. Martin Luther King and John Lewis, who is still a member of Congress, a senior member of Congress now, and others were marching for voting rights. And John Lewis led a march over the bridge in Selma, Edmund Pettus Bridge, and on national television, these peaceful marchers for a basic right were assaulted by the police and by onlookers. And it created a popular explosion of outrage. And this pushed Johnson and gave Johnson the opportunity to act and to propose the Voting Rights Act. He went before Congress and took the language of the civil rights movement and said to Congress, we shall overcome. And you are exactly right. It was the most successful civil rights law in American history. The key provision, there was a provision banning various ways that the right to vote had been blocked, such as literacy tests and other ways that people, very creative methods used to keep people from voting. And there was a requirement that if the states that had a history of discrimination in voting wanted to change their voting practices, maybe to go back to the old ways, they had to get approval in advance from the Justice Department or a federal court in Washington. Pre-clearance, it's called. And that turned out to be monumentally important. And over half a century, it really worked. And you have, by a decade ago, and even now, in the southern states, black voting rates are as high or even higher than white voting rates under this protection. And a lot of it had to do with this preclearance system. And that is the system that got gutted by the U.S. Supreme Court just a couple of years ago.
And that was the Shelby County decision?
That's right. It's a very significant case called Shelby County versus Holder. It was in 2013. And the Voting Rights Act had been reauthorized by Congress on several occasions. And it went before the Supreme Court again. And this time, the 5-2-4 conservative majority of the Roberts Court, which was so strong in those days before Justice Scalia's death, that 5-4 majority basically ruled Section 5 unconstitutional. It ruled the formula by which it could be used to be unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And this was a really monumental ruling. This is the case where Justice Scalia in the courtroom said that he thought that the Voting Rights Act was little more than, as he put it, a racial entitlement. People kind of gasped when he said that. He didn't write the opinion. Chief Justice Roberts did. Roberts said, look, that was then, this is now, it's not needed anymore. Things aren't this different in the South than there are elsewhere, and we don't need this special kind of protection. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote a dissent, a sort of a famous dissent. She said, look, that's like standing in a rainstorm holding an umbrella and not getting wet and deciding, therefore, you can throw away the umbrella mm-hmm. because you're not wet. She said, this is going to lead to bad things happening. And I would submit that, at least so far, her predictions have been much more accurate than those mm-hmm. of Chief Justice Roberts.
This is Bob Custer, and I'm speaking with Michael Waldman about his book, The Fight to Vote. The book looks at the history of voting rights from our country's founding up to the present day. I don't know whether you or anyone can answer my next question, but I guess I'm just curious whether reasonable legal minds can differ on the interpretation of the United States Constitution in this particular case, or whether this is just partisanship rearing its ugly head in the Supreme Court, which I guess happens from time to time.
You know, I think it's probably both. The Roberts Court repeatedly on these 5-4 votes on matters that were of critical importance to the Republican Party, they repeatedly ruled in pretty dramatic ways to strike down laws like this on the Citizens United case, on all kinds of other cases. And it tended to be things that, as a political matter, you could argue benefited the constituents of the party that nominated the justices. It's also the case that that's true in the other direction, too, and then that's certainly true in a lot of cases. There are disagreements that can be had always over the Constitution and how to interpret it. And what was a mistake, I think, in this particular case, the Congress could have done a better job in the end in how it adjusted the way the Voting Rights Act worked the last time that it was reauthorized. But what the court really did, which I think was a mistake, was to second-guess Congress, which was given, Congress was given the power under the Constitution, first and foremost, to protect voting rights. And what you really had was the justices voting as if they were in Congress, saying, well, I don't think this made sense. I just wouldn't do it this way, so it's overturned. That's not really the role properly for the courts. And, of course, you know, people debate this question of judicial activism.
Right.
You know, and for a long time it's been conservatives who've made just that exact same argument about the courts overstepping. And now it's liberals who say that about something like Citizens United, or they might say it about the Heller case on gun rights or whatever, and they say that it's progressives who think that the courts are overstepping their bounds.
So what's the impact of that Supreme Court decision on what's going on like right now at this minute as people are trying to register? And I ask specifically about the North Carolina law that I think was passed after this Supreme Court decision.
Yes. So in a bunch of places, almost like a cork that had been taken, popped out of a bottle of voting champagne. there was a lot of movement to quickly enact or implement these laws. In Texas, where my organization that I run, the Brennan Center, has been involved in challenging the law, just 2 hours after the Supreme Court ruled, a voter ID law was put into place that a federal court later ruled, when it was put into place, disenfranchised 608,000 voters in Texas, disproportionately minority, and was unconstitutional and illegal. And in North Carolina, you're right, the state passed a law that was sort of a greatest hits of different voting rules. there was a voter ID law, and I should note that I'm for voter ID. I think it's not crazy to require people to have to be who they say they are and require them to prove it. I think Idaho's law is pretty good. I don't think that's wrong. The problem is when they have these laws that require forms of ID that a lot of people just don't have. And about 11% of eligible voters don't have a driver's license. And so North Carolina passed one of those laws, and they looked at early voting, which was very successful there, as it is in so many other parts of the country. People really find it convenient, and, you know, about one in three voters now votes before Election Day. They looked at that, and they said they wanted to cut it back on the days used by black voters, especially the Sunday before Election Day. They ended same-day registration. They ended the campaign finance reform law for judicial races. I mean, it was really just everything all mushed together that you could think of.
You mean they just happened to pick the days that we know African-American voters were turning out, or they said they didn't say that, did they?
They actually did. This is what the courts found. The legislature asked the research bureau, could you tell us which voting practices are most used by African-Americans? And those were the ones they targeted.
Oh, my gosh.
In North Carolina, it's something called Souls to the Polls. It's basically an organizing program where the black churches use that day to rally their churchgoers to go vote. And that was the one day they really targeted for the reduction.
Yeah.
And they actually said in writing, please tell us which ones are used by black voters. And instead of saying, oh, we're going to be careful and not do that, those were the ones they did. The federal appeals court ruled that they had targeted black voters in North Carolina, as the court said, with almost surgical precision. And that's a striking thing. These laws passed, they moved around the country, a lot of them after the Shelby County case. But courts all over the country, especially this past summer, blocked the laws and stopped them from taking effect. And it was really striking because it was Democratic judges or Republican judges, liberal or conservative judges, state courts and federal courts stepped up and protected the right to vote. And it was really very encouraging. And so there's a lot of confusion in a lot of the country in this election about what the rules are, because they keep changing around. But at least in theory, in most of those places, the right to vote was protected. Now, some states, in Texas, for example, settled the case and then promptly didn't do the things it said it was going to do and has been hauled back into court. But for all the confusion and anxiety about what's going on in this election, there really should be confidence that people will have the ability to vote.
This reminds me of one of the quotes in your book. You quoted Paul Weyrich, one of the new right organizers who's been around for years, who said, they want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of the people. That really sums up where they're coming from, I suppose.
Well, and he said that at a very pivotal, original founding moment of the modern conservative movement. It was actually right after Ronald Reagan won the Republican nomination. It was his meeting with the what became the moral majority, the sort of conservative evangelical movement. And that was something that was said by one of the warm-up speakers, Paul Weyrich. And Weyrich's a significant figure because he founded the organization known as the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, which wrote a lot of these voting laws in the states. And he co-founded the organization, the Heritage Foundation, folks have probably heard of, which is a kind of major public booster of these laws. So Weyrich was a significant figure, and these laws, I think, are the product, I argue the facts show pretty clearly, are the product of a pretty concerted and explicitly political strategy. And they aren't needed. You know, we hear this election, and Donald Trump, for example, says that there's voter fraud everywhere and the elections are rigged. The one thing that now I'm happy to see is pretty much agreed on pretty widely is that this idea of widespread in-person voter fraud is just nonsense. It's just not true. And as a statistical matter, you are more likely to be hit by lightning than to commit in-person voter fraud and voter impersonation. And what's encouraging to me is that, again, really just in the last month or two, everybody agrees on that, Republican and Democratic officials, 30 states, the secretaries of state or the other people running the elections are Republican, and they've all said, hey, wait a minute, the elections are not rigged, and in fact, people's votes are going to count, and there's not widespread voter fraud. Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful that that will mark a new turning point, because those are the arguments that were used to justify these laws. And now, if we can all agree on the facts, maybe we can get to some better policies.
Exactly. You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Michael Waldman, author of The Fight to Vote. Well, if the elections are rigged, maybe they're rigged because of decisions like Citizens United. Could you tell us a little bit about that decision and its impact on this election, not to mention many others?
Yes, because while I don't think it's the case that people are going to see widespread voter fraud or even the voting machines being hacked, although you always have to worry with the evidence that the Russians are trying to
right.
mess with our elections, which I have to admit I didn't see coming. There are real problems in our democracy, ways it's broken, ways it needs to be fixed. I think that the Citizens United ruling, as you say, is one of the biggest, and has led to a tremendous imbalance in how money talks in elections. And, you know, it's interesting. We talk about Citizens United. That's only one of the cases. It's sort of like the shorthand for a series of cases the Supreme Court has issued over the years. You know, look, we have a democracy rooted in the ideal of one person, one vote, and we have a market economy, free market economy. We want the benefits of that. But we know that that's going to lead to a kind of accumulation of wealth, and that could have an impact on the democracy. And we've grappled with how to draw that line and make sure the impact is not too great. But the Supreme Court stepped in and obliterated quite a bit of that line. It ruled in 2010 in this Citizens United case. First of all, it said that there's prohibitions on corporations directly spending money in elections that go back a century, that go back to Theodore Roosevelt, who pushed for them. And the court said that corporations couldn't be treated differently from people in that respect. Interestingly, that got a lot of us very worried and angry and upset. But it turned out not to be nearly as significant as other parts of the ruling, which said basically that as long as an expenditure was supposedly independent, it couldn't be corrupting, independent of the candidate. And as a result of all this stuff taken together, you've had basically a complete deregulation of the rules around campaign finance, and mega donors, really, really wealthy people, have dominated it, pouring sums of money that were much greater than people had been able to do before, and really for the first time since the Gilded Age and the robber barons of long ago. To give just an example, in the last federal election, the top 100 donors gave more than the 4.75 million small donors combined. That is a hard way to sustain a democracy, because we know that the politicians listen to their donors in a lot of ways. Now, look, you know, Donald Trump didn't spend a lot of money in the Republican primaries. Jeb Bush blew through his $100 million in super PAC money. Bernie Sanders, as he kept telling us, raised his money through an average contribution of $27. You know, so it's not such a simple story. But nobody should make any mistake, especially below the level of the presidential races. Money is having a very harmful impact on the system right now.
Mm-hmm. You said toward the end of your book that, and these aren't your words, but as I remember them, you talked about how sterile our elections are, voting is, that it's a private affair. It's not exactly a team sport, I guess is one way to think about it. And I gather you were wondering, or at least ruminating about the possibility of our election system developing into something more robust or more participative or whatever you might call it.
Yeah, this election, it's, I guess it wouldn't be sterile would not be the first word
right.
that comes to mind. So be careful what you wish for, I suppose. You know, look, turnout right now is very low. In the last federal election, it went to the lowest it's been in 72 years. And that was in the middle of World War II. So there are a lot of people overseas fighting, and they kind of had an excuse. And you have to wonder, why is it that we have such low turnout in the United States? You know, when we talked at the beginning that it was more of a contact sport back in the 1800s, there were really strong political parties. It was participatory. There weren't TV ads, but there were a lot of parades. a lot of it was public. It was actually what I was talking about in the book. Interestingly, it was before the secret ballot. And, of course, we all, I at least, support the secret ballot. We understand that to be the heart of part of what makes an election fair. But it may also have dampened turnout because people vote when they see their friends voting, when they see their neighbors voting, when they understand they're doing it, you know, as part of a tribe, as part of a community. And, you know, I think we would be better off in this country if we had stronger parties. We also have, in addition to the sense that people have that the rules are rigged by something like Citizens United, we have the gerrymandering problem where, you know, the politicians draw the lines of the districts. And they do it in such a way that there's very frequently no competition at all. You know who's going to win before the election's even held. And so people don't show up because they don't think there's particularly strong reason to vote. For a lot of different reasons, our participation rate lags way behind Europe, Canada, and Mexico, and other countries. So, you know, I do think that social media, that a lot of the new ways that people communicate with each other, offers a hopeful direction because people really do talk to each other and rally each other and organize each other in a way that way. And it isn't just like watching TV ads paid for by super PACs.
So in 2016, 15 states have new laws that make it harder to vote for the first time in a presidential election. Are there any states in particular that you're concerned about as you look at all these new laws that will impede the right to vote?
Well, many of the worst states have been blocked by the courts, so Texas and North Carolina. And while we all have to be very attentive to make sure that there's not shenanigans and ways in which the state governments don't follow what they're supposed to do, at least the courts have stepped in. There are some other states, Wisconsin is a good example, where the laws that were passed with bad intent are still on the books. And one of the recent leaks of documents were flooded with these emails now. This one was not hacked. We don't think it was leaked by somebody who was on the inside, but it was a series of documents from Wisconsin where Governor Scott Walker and his political operation were involved in a judicial election, and that was actually what the investigation was about. It wasn't about voting issues. But in the middle of this set of emails, there's an email from one of Governor Walker's political operatives to the other ones saying, hey, it looks like things aren't going to go so well for our candidate. Do you think we should start claiming voter fraud now or wait till people actually vote? I say now.
Oh, well,
And everyone said, good idea. You know, good heads up all there. And that just shows, you know, it was pretty clear. This voter ID law in Wisconsin is not to solve any kind of real problem. It was to make it harder for people, for the students at the University of Wisconsin or the inner city residents of Milwaukee or whoever it was who might vote for Democrats, make it harder for them to vote. And I think that's one of the places where there could be real problems. Mm-hmm. I also think that there's a worry that a lot of us have that with all the talk of rigged elections, with all the talk of voter fraud and the encouragement of the Trump campaign, a lot of people are going to show up and try to disrupt the polling places. Poll watching is something that is allowed. It's tightly regulated. You cannot use the opportunity to watch the polls to intimidate voters. And it's pretty clear that a lot of the things that have been said have encouraged people to go and do just that. And, you know, one of the lawsuits that is unclear as of this conversation, what's going to happen is the Democratic Party just sued the Republican Party in court over this. And so we're going to see these rules litigated and negotiated up until the last minute.
Michael, we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book is The Fight to Vote, by Michael Waldman. What a perfect time to sit down and read this book as you get ready to cast your ballot. Thanks so much, Michael. Appreciate you joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this encore presentation of my interview with Michael Waldman. Look for an updated version of The Fight to Vote when we interview Carol Anderson, author of One Person, No Vote, An Analysis of Voter Suppression in America Today. Next week, Megan O'Sullivan, author of Windfall.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Brady Moore. Our producer is Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.